The poem Omeros by Derek Walcott, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1992, the poem is way too long to be read, even over 10 or 20 pieces of audio. So I'm going to skip and pick a piece from chapter 11. In fact, I'm intending to read the whole of chapter 11 right up to maybe chapter 11, 12, 13, and finish book one there. And it's a continuation of some pieces that I've already read. And that's as much so that I can familiarize myself with Derek Walcott's work as it is to give a gift of some more poetry to my great friend A.J. Leon and his wife Melissa Leon, who are traveling all the way around the world. And the concept that began with these poetry readings, especially for them, was the idea that while you're travelling, it's sometimes very nice to have a piece of poetry with you. Anyway, chapter 11 begins. Pigs were his business. By the way, I have no idea who hears us at this stage. So pigs were his business. These people were not resigned to living with garbage, drifting in numbed content as the filth narrowed the drains. They had not designed the attic ideal of the first slave settlement with sea grapes for olives and black philosophers with clouds over their elbows. They had not laid out narrow gauge pipes for buckets, but none for sewers. They had not sucked the cane till sugar was played out. Empires were swinish. These had splendid habits of cleanliness, compulsively sweeping yards dry with their palm brooms, encouraged to screw like rabbits by estates who liked labour, and naturally by a church that damned them to hell for contraceptives. But they waxed their tables, flayed their beaten laundry on the river rocks. There were icons in their lives. The virgin lamp, the steps lined with flowers. And they learned quickly, good repairers of engines, and fanatical maids. Helen had kept the house as if it were her own. And that's when it all begins, when the maid turns into the mistress and destroys her own possibilities. They start to behave as if they owned you, Maud said. This was the distress of the pale lemon frock which Helen claimed Maud gave her, but forgot. He stayed out of it. But that dress had an empire's tag on it, mistress to slave. The price was envy and cunning. The big church, the middens by cloudy lagoons, kids racing like piglets. If history saw them as pigs, history was Circe, with her schoolteacher's wand, with high poles at the fates of Saint Day processions, past alfresco latrines. So Plunkett decided that what the place needed was its true place in history, that he'd spend hours for Helen's sake on research. So he proceeded to the whirr of enormous moths in the still house. Memory's engines. The butterfly dress was hers. At least her namesake's in the Battle of the Saints. Part 2. During this period, his life grew increasingly bookish and slippered like a don's. He stayed in. Maud wondered about his wound. When she took in his tea, he nodded towards the side table, and this made her leave him with his ziggurat of books, his charts and the balsa fleet he craved. He carved with a small scalpel, while she sipped hers in the arched shade with her orchids. Dusk darkened the pots, an alamander's bell bronzed in the sky fire and then melted into night. Dennis was still at work when she took her tray in. The desk was dark except for a green pool of light cast on its bays by a lamp curved like a heron. She sat on a chair beside him. He didn't speak, and the tea was untouched. One finger traced the line of some map, and the nose, with its man-o-war war's beak, skimmed the white page. She had never felt more alone. A light wind had washed the stars. They looked very close. Maud sighed, then went upstairs. She could feel the white sea losing its white noise slowly, drawing the windows. She studied the map on one forearm, then briskly loosened the bridle knot of the mosquito net, then stretched it to the corners of the tautened pane, carried the straw basket with the bright spools in it down to the divan, her needle swift as his pen. Part 3. She thought, I dreamed of this house with woods around it, with trees I'd read of, whose flowers I'd never seen. Parts of a barracks with no noise to surround it, but kikadas chattering like my sewing machine. I loved the little teak with bodies clean as birches, in light that flecked the leopard shade of the path. When martens at dusk with their crisscrossing stitches would sew the silk sky or preen around the bird bath. I saw it when we first came. Unapproachable cliff on one side, but its ledges a nesting place for folding herons and gulls, and my teak table with its lion claw legs and its varnished surface spread with fine scalloped linen, white as the sea's lace and ringing crystal, with a fresh wreath of orchids, like Remembrance Day, at my brass candlestick's base. In Dennis's honour, mainly, and the place cards near the bone china of my huge lily pad plates. Have I put on airs to think of dinner candles and flags and lances, since we slow marched down the aisle under crossed swords? Then my tureen with thick handles hefted by Helen, her cap white as my napkins, rolled in their crested folders. She'd set it in place, and step back in shadow that bent with her fine skins. What a loss, that girl. I ladled the fragrant steam of my stew in thick portions, the dark full of fireflies that never catch the leaves. It's as clear as a dream, but more real. Well, folks lived for centuries like this, with candles and airs on the piano, the love songs fading over a firefly sky, over a firefly sea, their mouths round as the moon, over a black canoe, like the one I smiled at today. In God we trust. But then we all trust in him, and that's why we know the peace of a wandering heart when it is housed. Chapter 12. Our house with its bougainvillea trellises, the front porch gone, was a printery. In its noise I was led up the cramped stair to its offices. I saw the small window near which we slept as boys, how close the roof was, the heat of the galvanize. A desk in my mother's room, not that bed, sunlit, with its rose quilt where we were forbidden to sit. Pink handbills whirred under their spinning negative, and the two girls stacked them from their retractable bed as fast as my own images were reprinted as I remembered them in an earlier life that made the sheets, linen, the machines, furniture. Her wardrobe, her winged, angelic mirror. The hum of the wheels, elbow stopped, and there was a figure framed in the quiet window for whom this was home, tracing its dust, rubbing thumb and middle finger, then coming to me, not past, but through the machines, clear as a film and as perfectly projected as a wall cut by the jealousy's slanted lines. He had done a self-portrait. It was accurate. In his transparent hand was a book I had read. Quote, "In this pale blue notebook where you found my verses," end quote. My father smiled. Quote, "I appeared to make your life's choice and the calling that you practice both reverses and honors mine from the moment it blent with yours. Now that you are twice my age, which is the boy's, which is the father's?" "Sir," I swallowed, "they are one voice." In the printer's noise, and as we went downstairs in that now familiar and unfamiliar house, he said, in an accent of polished weariness, "I was raised in this obscure Caribbean port, where my bastard father christened me for his shire, Warwick, the Bard's County, but never felt part of the foreign machinery known as literature. I preferred verse to fame, but I wrote with the heart of an amateur. It's that will you inherit. I died on his birthday, 1 April. Your mother sewed her own costume as Portia. Then that disease, like Hamlet's old man, spread from an infected ear. I believe the parallel has brought you to some peace. Death imitating art, eh?" At the door to the yard, he said, "I grew grapes here. Small, a little sour, still grapes all the same." "I remember them," I said. "I thought they died before you were born." "Are you sure?" "Yes. The furled nap like nettles, their globes green acid. What was Warwick doing, transplanting Warwickshire? I saw him patterned in shade, the leaves in his hair, the vines of the loosened body, the swift's brown seed." Part 2. Out on the sidewalk, the sunlight drained like the print of a postcard flecked with its gnawing chemical, in which there was light, but with a sepia tint, even on Grass Street, with our Methodist chapel. We passed under uprights with fretworks on their eaves, mansards with similar woodwork, their verandas shuttered at both corners by half-cranked jalousies through which pale cousins peered, or a half-cracked aunt, as if from the madhouse or a convent. Windows framed their unshifting lives. During the hot long day, they kept changing posts near which they leant, their elbows jutting from a ledge, elbows as well known as they were, or with a white head dipping in a rocker, while the black town walked barefoot and deafening bells pounded the Angelus. But none saw the walker in his white suit, Their reveries were somewhere else. They looked on their high brown life as a souvenir, with a dried Easter palm, its amber sweets, its carts horse-drawn, rubbing their beads and muttering, "Veni, Creator," to velvet cushions with embroidered hearts, as iron bells ruled the town, and the pooey flowers fell. Part 3. It was one. We passed the brown phantoms in white drill suits, some with pith helmets, whom the Angelus sent back to work after lunch. Suits rippled by the grill of shade made by the long-stemmed pillars as we went past them. The asphalt so hot that it was empty. Heat waves rippled over it, and one or two cars pumped their bulb horns and waved as they rattled by. Then we came to a green square cut in smaller squares, and the light from a bluer postcard filled its sky, and it seemed from his steps that water sprang in plumes from the curled iron-green fountain at its centre, though its gates were shut under plumed cabbage palms, a paradise I had to believe to enter. But I did not ask him about the other life, because the white shadow I had made from my mind was vague in its origin and thin as belief, unsinged as an Easter lily, fresh as the wind, its whisper as soft as a pavement scratching leaf. I'll stop. The remainder of we have chapter 13. Chapter 13 is quite long. And it's the end of book one. So let me just read you to finish the very last part of chapter 13. Along this cold blackened wharf, what time decided to do with my treacherous body after this, he said, watching the women, will stay in your head. As long as a question you have no right to ask, only to doubt, not hate our infuriating silence. I am only the shadow of that task as much as their work, your pose of a question waiting, as you crouch with a writing lamp over a desk, remains in the darkness after the light has gone. And whether night is palpable between dawn and dusk is not for the living, so you mind your business, which is life and work like theirs. But I will say this, O thou, my zero, is an impossible prayer. Utter extinction is still a doubtful conceit. Though we pray to nothing, nothing cannot be there. Kneel on your load, then balance your staggering feet and walk up that cold ladder, as they do in time, one bare foot after the next, in ancestral rhyme, because rhyme remains the parenthesis of palms, shielding a candle's tongue. It is the language's desire to enclose the loved world in its arms, or heft a cold bucket. Only by its stages, like those groaning women, will you achieve that height, whose wooden planks and couplets lift your pages higher than those hills of infernal anthracite. There, like ants or angels, they see their native town, unknown, raw, insignificant. They walk, you write. Keep to that narrow causeway without looking down, climbing in their footsteps that slow ancestral beat of those used to climbing roads. Your own work owes them, because the couplet of those multiplying feet made your first rhymes. Look, they climb, and no one knows them. They take their copper pittances, and your duty, from the time you watched them from your grandmother's house as a child wounded by their power and beauty, is the chance you now have to give those feet a voice. We stood in the hot afternoon. My father took his fob watch from its pocket, replaced it, and said, lightly gripping my arm, he enjoys a good talk, a serious trim, and I myself look ahead to our appointment. He kissed me.